Message this morning comes from the 8th chapter of Paul's letter to the Romans. Romans chapter 8, reading verses 31 through 37. Hear the word of God. What shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who is against us? He who did not spare his very own son, but handed him over for us all, how will he not also with him freely give us all things? Who will bring charges against God's chosen ones? God who justifies? Who is going to condemn? Christ Jesus who died? Yes, rather, who was raised? Who also is at the right hand of God? Who also intercedes for us? Who will separate us from the love of Christ? Affliction? Distress? Persecution? Hunger? Nakedness? Danger or sword? Just as it stands written, on your account we are put to death the whole day long. We are regarded as sheep for slaughter. No, in all these things we are super conquerors through him who loved us. I want you to consider the I shall not want of the New Testament, and it's found in Romans chapter 8 and verse 32. Perhaps if you remember the way Psalm 23 begins, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, in the traditional King James Version. It begins to conjure up the scenes and part of the scenery of Psalm 23. Green pastures, quiet waters, and all of that. But if Paul's statement in Romans 8:32 adds anything to David's gem in his psalm, it is this: that if you really want the most compelling, the clearest proof that you will never want in the sense of lack anything you need, that you won't find it really in the green pastures and the quiet waters, but you will find it among the noisy mob outside of city wall, among jeering priests and grief-stricken women and confused disciples and indifferent soldiers and writhing victims and frightening darkness and shaking earth, there you'll find the proof that you will never want anything if you are his. Or as Paul puts it in Romans 8:32, he who did not spare his own son, but handed him over for us all, how shall he not also with him freely give us all things? I want that to be burnt on your mind, if possible, as you come to his table this morning. First of all, you see there the costliness of God's love. He who did not spare even his own son. It's easy to think that Calvary didn't cost God the Father very much. Sometimes we get into perversions of the gospel that run something like this. That of course God's wrath and judgment was upon human sin. And because of that, that wrath and that judgment came upon Jesus. Jesus suffered it for you. And God inflicted that judgment upon him. And if we're not careful, then it comes out meaning or conveying something like this: Jesus is nice, look what he did for you. God is nasty, look what he put Jesus through. That is not the gospel, not that part. You see, it's the costliness of God's love that's in the gospel. He who did not spare even his own son. You dare not think that Calvary cost God the Father nothing. In fact, the apostle seems to want to make that point with us because he uses this verb to spare. He did not spare his own son. Now, the verb that Paul uses here is a Greek word that was used when about 200 years before Christ, they translated the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek.
And they use this very same word in Genesis 22, verses 14 and 16. You remember Genesis 22 talks about the time when God tested Abraham and told him to offer up his only son Isaac as a burnt offering. And Abraham went through with everything right up to the point of offering and sacrificing his son when God stepped in and stopped him and so on. And so in Genesis 22:12, God says to Abraham, "Now I know that you fear God," or the angel says to him, "I know that you fear God because you have not spared or withheld your son, your only one, from me." It's the same verb. Abraham did not spare Isaac. He would go that far. And here, God is the one who did not spare his very own son. It's as if Paul perhaps wants to put a little mental trip in your way here and make you think about Genesis 22. That cost Abraham something. You know, I know the writer of Genesis 22 isn't trying to make a big point of it. You know that the writer there in Genesis 22 never tells you how Abraham felt, because it didn't matter how he felt. What mattered was whether he obeyed, and he did. The writer doesn't spill Abraham's psychological guts all over the page at Genesis 22 in order to move you to tears. He just ignores that element of it. But you don't think, do you, that that whole procedure left Abraham unmoved? Surely you don't. You don't think it was just a routine bit of work for Abraham, do you? You don't think that it didn't wrench him, do you? So when you read that God did not spare his own son, you don't think, do you, that that was a routine matter with God the Father? You don't think, do you, that he regarded it as just another piece of heavenly administrative office work? You don't think, do you, that this one, Jesus the Son, who said the Father loves the Son, you don't think that if that is true, you don't think then that the Father wasn't moved? That it didn't cost him something when he did not spare his own son? Surely you don't. That's the thrust of that story I told to a group in our Lenten services last spring, of a story that Peter Moore tells in one of his books about a little girl who was rather embarrassed about her mother's hands. Her mother had scarred, rather ugly hands, and she didn't know why her mother had those kind of hands when all the other kids' mothers had smooth, soft hands. She didn't say anything about it once she noticed it, because she was rather embarrassed by it. But as time went on, she became rather ashamed of those hands. And finally, when she could bear it no longer, she just came out with it and asked her mother, "Why do you have such ugly hands, Mommy, when other girls' and kids' mothers' hands are so pretty and soft and so on?" It was finally out, and she was a bit relieved just from having said it. So her mother sat her down. She said, "Well, dear, it was like this. When you were still a very young child, in fact, you were still sleeping in the crib, we had a fire in our house. And I went in and I found that flames were all around your crib. And so I grabbed the blanket and wrapped you up in it, and the flames had even begun to take alight the edges and the outer part of that blanket. And so you see, that's why Mommy's hands are ugly and scarred and not like your friend's mother's hands." Well, there was a pause, and then a sort of a light came on in her eyes, and a little girl took her mother's hands in hers. Then she pressed them to her cheeks, and she said, "Oh, Mommy, Mommy, I just love these hands." Not just that she gave her hands, but that she did not spare her hands. The costliness of love. And that isn't anything near what it seems and must have cost God in what he did not spare his very own son. You see, there's a difference between the living God and Abraham, for in Genesis 22, God refused to allow Abraham to go through with that. He stopped him. So there's a sense in which Abraham didn't spare his son Isaac in that he was willing to go through with that if need be, but God stopped him. God refused to allow Abraham to go through with it. But what God would not allow Abraham to do, he himself did, in that he did not spare his son. And if that's true, if God's love was that costly, then don't you, Christian believer, have to say that verse 31 must be true? Surely God is for us. And if that is true, who is against us? But not only is there the costliness of God's love here, but secondly, there's the mystery of God's ways. You see that in the next line. He who did not spare his own son, but handed him over for us all. Handed him over for us all. There's the mystery. How is that a mystery? Well, because that same verb is used in other texts in the New Testament where God isn't doing the handing over. You see, this verb that Paul uses here in verse 32, handed over, is a verb that sometimes is translated betrayed in the English, depending on the context. Sometimes it's translated to give up or to hand over. If you keep the translation to hand over, you'll get a fairly literal but a rough idea of the meaning as it's used in various texts. You know that toward the end of Mark's gospel, for example, in the section that deals with the death and suffering of Jesus, that you find this verb used three times. Mark 14, verse 10. Judas went to the chief priests to betray, to hand over Jesus to them. Mark 15, verse 1. The chief priests and the rest of the Jewish leaders, it says, led Jesus away and handed him over to Pilate. Mark chapter 15, again, verse 15. Pilate had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. And then our text. But handed him over for us all. And God is doing the handing over. It's the very same Greek verb. Interesting how the same language might have a different connotation some ways. That was true when David Watson, who was an Anglican clergyman, was diagnosed with cancer. This was back in the 80s sometime. And he tells in his book, Fear No Evil, about a certain time when he had been dismissed from the hospital after having received treatment. And someone called up, someone who was concerned about his condition. They called up a Bible college over there in England that apparently had some relationship and knowledge of Reverend Watson, and they asked how he was doing. And the folks at the Bible college said over the phone, well, he has gone home. The rumor then went out that Mr. Watson had died. What they meant was he had gone home from the hospital, but they took it as in that other sense of gone home that we sometimes use. And the same language was used with a different shade of meaning. There's a sense in which that is true here. You have the same language. You have a little bit different import, perhaps. You have Judas handing Jesus over, the chief priests and company handing him over. You have Pilate handing him over, but above all, you have God who handed him over for us all. And the mystery gets deeper because you see in the words of institution to the Lord's Supper in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 23, which we used at the beginning of our service, in the night in which he was betrayed, handed over, same verb, Jesus took bread. Who's the subject of the verb there in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 23? Literally, in the night in which he was being handed over. Is it Judas? That's the way it's usually taken. Or is it God? In any case, we can let it be Judas in that occasion, but the same verb is used here in Romans 8:32. God handed him over for us all. Can you put all that together? Do you see the mystery in God's ways? As one writer in the 19th century put it, who handed Jesus over to death? And he answers his question, not Judas for money, not Pilate for fear, not the Jews for envy, but God for love. You must see the mystery of that, that Judas or Pilate or the Jews can hand Jesus over, but behind it all and in it all and through it all, it's really God who handed him over for us all. That's the mystery of God's ways. Now, your duty, if you're a Christian, is not to solve the truth, but merely to see the truth and receive the truth. And you can at least see the mystery there, can't you? That men may do their worst. Men may plot and scheme, etc., etc., but God is doing his work, either through or in spite of it all. The mystery of God's ways. And you need to see, perhaps, some comfort in that for your own situations. If it's true that what you have here, you have in Judas, the chief priests, and Pilate, etc., you have an act, a treacherous, unfaithful, diabolical act of infidelity, that in that, nevertheless, God was at work redeeming his people. Then could it not also be true that in our lesser difficulties, when in circumstances we are in darkness, when in our circumstances we can't see the way through or see how we can hang on or see what on earth God could possibly be doing in the midst of unfaithfulnesses that we may be suffering? Could it not be true that the same God who in the face of Judas handing over nevertheless had handed over his son for us all to redeem us, could it not be true that God in all the muck and the yuck in which you are is also at work redeeming and restoring and sanctifying? It's hard to see, you see, because it's the mystery of God's ways, and it's hard to figure out mysteries. And then thirdly, you see in our text the assurance of God's provision. Thirdly, the assurance of God's provision. You see where Paul goes with this. He who did not spare his own son, but handed him over for us all, how shall he not also with him freely give us all things? In logic, that's often referred to as an argument from the greater to the less. That doesn't fit here. It's an argument here from the greatest to the less. Paul is saying, if in fact God gave all that he could give in his own son, then is there any need of yours, any lesser need, that he cannot and will not supply? If he has given you Christ, could there be anything else that he will hold back? I think it was J.I. Packer in his book, Knowing God, who said something like this, that God will always give all that we need. And what he gives, whether materially or spiritually, will always be enough for the present moment. Now, it's that kind of thing that Paul seems to take up here. We need to ask, though, what does he mean when he says he will graciously give us all things with Christ? All things. What does the all things include? Well, it certainly includes what in verse 31 is called these things. You know, when the apostle says, what should we say to these things? Well, what are these things? Well, at least the stuff that he had talked about in Romans chapter 8 so far. What were these things? Well, verse 1, Acquittal in the face of condemnation. That's what he gives believers. What else? Well, verses 9 to 11, resurrection in the face of the threat of death. What else? Well, verses 12 through 17, adoption in the face of fear. Adoption's the word for God's special child care for his people. Adoption in the face of fear. What else? Verses 18 to 25, hope in the face of distress and suffering. What else? Verses 27, 26 and 27, assistance in the face of frustration in prayer. And what else? Verses 28 to 30, the certainty of complete transformation into the moral likeness of Jesus. And so Paul says, what shall we say to these things? God is surely for us. But the all things of verse 32 even embraces more, it seems, than the these things of verse 31. All that, and in fact, all things. What things? All things that the believer may need. Now, that's as God defines our need, I think we need to say. What are some samples of what that all things might include? Well, I think it includes, for one thing, perseverance in the Christian life. Perseverance in the Christian life. You see, you may think that verse 32 is just a little bit of spiritual morphine to deaden your pain while you're in church. And then you go out of here and you go into the real crud, and then it wears off. But Paul knew better. He wasn't hiding his head in the sand when he wrote verse 32. How do we know that? Well, because he wrote it right at the head of verses 35 and 36, where he said, who will separate us from the love of Christ? What do we meet in the Christian life? And he goes on to tell it. Affliction, distress, persecution, hunger, nakedness, danger, or sword. And so when the Apostle Paul wrote verse 32, his eyes weren't closed. He knew what was coming. He knew what we meet in the Christian life. Verse 32 is not a neat little ditty suitable for decoupaging to put on your wall. It's real stuff. Paul's sober when he wrote that. Because after it, he wrote verse 35. And when you see that, don't you look at those candidates for separating you from Christ's love in verse 35? And as you consider those things, haven't you ever asked this question? How will I ever make it through in the Christian life? How will I endure? Your questions might be a bit different, but surely they come. How can I hold up? How can I weather this particular storm I'm in just now? What if my comfortable world that I enjoy just now tumbles in on me? What if I lose the resources I have? What if my health fails? What if, and so on and so forth. What if I hit persecution? What then? Paul says, the God who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, as included in that gift, all lesser gifts. How then will I endure and make it through the crud I'm in and be faithful to Jesus in it? How can I? Why will I? Because God did not spare his own son. And in that greatest gift, he's included all other gifts. Perseverance in the Christian life. And then there's also the matter of what we could call provision for daily needs. That's included in the all things. Provision for daily needs. The daily bread stuff, you know. That seems to be part of what God promises his people. In Psalm 111 anyway, he provides food for those who fear him. He is ever mindful of his covenant. The daily provision of basic stuff. And so on. And we have to say here that we don't mean the health and wealth gospel that you hear on a number of TV evangelists proclaiming and that sort of thing. It isn't that God is going to provide you with a certain standard of living or something like that, but the all things includes all that you need to sustain life as long as God wills you to live for his glory here. Daily provision. I think the one who probably pulled that together the nicest or the most helpful way for me was a fellow I told you about once before in northeastern Scotland by the name of John Murray. Poverty had hit that area of Scotland in the mid-19th century. The potato crops were not very good, and they had a struggle. And it so happened that one day John Murray had a relative from his clan come and visit him, and he was there for the midday meal. The midday meal was always salt and potatoes, or potatoes and salt, whichever you care. In any case, his visitor and relative was trying to be sympathetic with John Murray as he commented on how sad it was that the potatoes were so poor. John Murray replied, "There's not a one of them on which I don't see the beauty of the blood. Not a one of them on which I don't see the beauty of the blood. What on earth does that mean?" That means that John Murray believed that when God did not spare his own son but handed him over for us all and gave us the greatest riches that we could ever want, that he will never be deficient in even giving and supplying our daily provisions, our much lesser needs, even if it's poor potatoes that he uses to sustain us. And that's why on every one of those poor potatoes he saw the beauty of the blood. They were purchased blessings by the God who had given up his own son. And what about you? Most of you today, anyway, will be able to walk away from this service when it's over. Most of you will have transportation to your destination, home, or wherever. Most of you today will have shelter and a place to stay that is reasonably warm. And probably most of you will have a midday meal. Well, that takes care of today, doesn't it? God didn't spare his own son. And he's giving you part of the all things with him for today. The statement Paul makes in the text is his declaration. God did not spare even his own son. You must draw the conclusion from that. You must say, I shall not want. It's appropriate then, as we come to the table of our Lord who sustains his people, that we come in prayer. It's an unfamiliar prayer, that hymn on your insert, but I want you to pray it as we sing it. The first four stanzas.